This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest today, Ellen Harper, grew up in the 50s and 60s, surrounded by folk music icons, immersed in songs about unions and civil rights, as well as blues, hymns, and gospel music. Her parents founded the Folk Music Center in Claremont, California, east of L.A. Ellen has worked there much of her life, in addition to having been a professor of education at Cal State in San Bernardino and singing and playing with several bands. She runs the center now. Her son, Ben Harper, who's with us too, also grew up in the Folk Music Center and became a Grammy Award-winning singer, songwriter, and guitarist. Ben has written the foreword to Ellen's memoir, Always a Song, Singers, Songwriters, Sinners, and Saints, My Story of the Folk Music Revival. The Folk Music Center became a place to buy, repair, and restore guitars and banjos, learn to play guitar and banjo, and gather with other musicians. Ellen's parents founded the Folk Music Center in 1958 after her father was blacklisted for refusing to name names and lost his teaching job. It was Pete Seeger who suggested that if he started a shop selling and repairing instruments, he'd never have to worry about being hired or fired. Ellen and Ben Harper spoke with Terry Gross.
Ellen Harper, Ben Harper, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you on our show. I want to start with a song. It's called A House is a Home, and it's from the album of duets that you recorded together called Childhood Home. You recorded this in 2013. It was released in 2014. And Ben, this was when you decided you wanted to do an album of duets with your mother. What made you decide to do that?
Well, I recorded a record with my mom because it was something I had always wanted to do. We used to sing around the house constantly. So for me, growing up and growing into being a professional musician, it just made too much sense. She's so good and has so many great songs, is such a great writer, and I had to take the opportunity.
Well, let's hear the song. This is Ellen and Ben Harper duetting on Ben's song, A House is a Home.
A house is a home, even when it's dark. Even when the grass is overgrown in the yard. Even when the dog is too old to bark. And when you're sitting at the table trying not to start. A house is a home, even when we've all been gone. Even when you're there alone. Even when there's ghosts, even when you gotta run from the ones who love you most. Screen doors, broken paints peeling from the wood. Locals whisper when they're gonna leave a neighborhood. A house is a home, even when we've up and gone. Even when you're there alone.
That's my guests, Ellen and Ben Harper, duetting on A House is a Home. So, Ellen Harper, home was where you lived, but the Folk Music Center was where you grew up in a lot of ways. What was it like as a childhood home for you?
I think sometimes when you're young, a child growing up, you accept what is in your environment as what's normal and what is home. It wasn't until I was a little older that I realized it was a very unique situation and learned to appreciate the different kinds of people that came through our lives, both at the store and in our actual home.
In addition to having, you know, the store, your family also had a performance space in which a lot of folk musicians and blues musicians would come and perform, and many of them would stay at your house. So who stayed at your house? Who are some of those luminaries?
See, we had the Brownie McGee and Sonny Terry stayed quite often. We had Doc Watson, and sometimes Doc Watson would have Clarence Ashley with him. and Hetty West, Gene Ritchie, who is both Gene and Hetty became very good friends of my mother. We had Mike Seeger. In fact, the whole New Law City Ramblers stayed at the house from time to time.
And this was during the folk music revival. So the musicians who you mentioned were really revered. And there was a growing awareness and growing popularity of folk music. So you were a part of this really important culture or subculture as a child and as a young woman and an adult. Ben, when you were a child, your mother was working at the Folk Music Center, and she had her hands full because she had three children. You had two brothers.
Yes.
So after school, you'd go to the Folk Music Center. Describe what it was like for you as a child growing up there.
It was a wonderland. You know, any sound that you could imagine could be made seemed to be inside those four walls. And the players that would come in and pick an instrument off the wall and be as high a level of virtuoso as you could possibly hear. At the time, like my mom had mentioned, you take it somewhat for granted because you think that it's normal, and then you grow into recognizing that her parents, my grandparents, created one of the most special musical environments I've ever seen. And also that carried over to the home as well. When we'd run out of room for storage, the instruments would end up in our living room. So as a child, my brothers and I got to put our hands on so many different instruments and were allowed to. You know, my mom, I think, let me play her most expensive Martin guitar till I finally put a ding in it, a scratch in it. And she said, enough is enough, and, you know, pulled me a $25 nylon string guitar.
Ben, how did the music you grew up with affect the music that you make as a singer and songwriter?
In a very deep way, in a profound way, having access to not only my mom's instruments, but her incredible record collection that, per my memory, ranged from Judy Collins and Woody Guthrie all the way to Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, Otis Redding, Sam Cooke. Does that all sound right, Mom?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And this may be out of turn, but I don't think I've ever seen you as frustrated as we had to leave our childhood home for a while because things got bad. When we came back, the one thing that was missing from our house was my mom's record collection. Mom, I don't think I've seen you that upset to this day.
Yes, and the only record that was left on the shelf was Blood on the Tracks, Bob Dylan.
I think the title was supposed to mean something.
It was, yes. I think it was sending a message.
Terry, a long-winded way of saying I had access to that collection. And finally, again, when I had put the final scratch in one of my mom's coveted albums, what did she do? She went to Radio Shack and got me a small turntable, small speakers, and said, here, you know, here's some lunch money. Get yourself, start your own collection kind of thing. And here's a few of mine that, since you've already kind of had your way with, you can have those ones as well. So the music from my mom, the music I was hearing in the music store, then my mom's personal collection, and then my personal evolution towards music that grew through my formative years into hip-hop, solely hip-hop, for a good decade. All of that ends up being some part of the sound that I make.
Ellen, your family was very political. Your grandmother was accused of being a communist, and she was jailed. The center, the Folk Music Center, was started because your father was blacklisted and he lost his job as a teacher. What was it like for you as a child to know that your grandmother had been jailed, that your father had lost his job, your family had to move as a result to start over again? I would imagine you felt that politics was important, and it was also risky and dangerous.
That's true. When my father was blacklisted and called before the HUAC in Massachusetts, I was 7 years old. And I can tell you, like, a brief story what it was like as a seven-year-old to go back to school the first day after this news broke that my father was fired for being a communist. Because it was on the radio, it was in the newspaper, and it was even on the evening news, the television news. And I went to school as usual. It was a drizzly day. And when I were lining up in front of the school to go on into the building, the secretary of the school asked me to step aside out of the line. And I noticed that kids were pointing and giggling and, you know, commie Jew remarks, pinko, pinko. So she set me out of the line, and then everyone went inside. She closed the door. And I was standing there looking at the door. I was wearing my most beloved pink raincoat and red galoshes, and it's drizzling rain. And I looked at that big door, and I thought, I am never wearing this raincoat again. It was pink, and that was that literal seven-year-old mind. So then to go home and try to tell my parents what a horrible day it was, and to hear an ideological argument about why I have to get over it, was not, it was not something that I could, that brain, that age of brain could really absorb. So to me, it felt like suddenly nobody liked me anymore. Something was wrong with me. And it took a few years to overcome that.
Oh, yeah, because you were getting insulted at school because of your father's politics, and your parents, instead of comforting you, they said, hey, toughen up, just go back.
That's exactly what they did, and that's exactly what I did.
So do you think it did strengthen you?
I think it strengthened me, but I think having your world turned upside down, just having the rug pulled right out from under you from one day to the next, makes you feel that the world is not a secure place, that nothing is permanent.
So, you know, Pete Seeger told your father, set up your own business, do, you know, start this like shop to sell and repair instruments, and then you won't have to worry about being hired or fired. So your father must have known Pete Seeger, or I guess it was your mother who knew Pete Seeger well enough to say, hey, help us out here. Give us some advice.
Yes, he did. My mother taught guitar and banjo lessons at Hecht House, which was a community center in Boston. And she took the classes over from Bess Hawes when Bess moved to California. And Pete used to come into the classes to see Bess and help out. So some of the classes were huge, and he'd help out. And he would come to my mother's classes occasionally as well. And one day, I think my mother just prevailed on him to come to the house for dinner because my father was really sinking under that morass of no job and not able to protect his family. So Pete came out and had dinner, and they got to talking politics, and then they got to talking banjos. My father, raised on a farm in New Hampshire, could fix anything. So it didn't take him long to figure out how a banjo would play at its best, what the action should be like, and how to set it up and all the moving parts. And so he started with banjos and then moved to guitars. And he and Pete, in that conversation, got to talking about banjos, and he showed Pete some of the banjo bridges that he had designed. And Pete said that was just a, you know, phenomenal idea, because banjo bridges always never seemed to be right. And that's when he encouraged him to start his own store so that he wouldn't be beholden to the whims of politics.
Ellen, you met your first husband, Leonard Harper, at a party in which there were some musicians jamming, and Leonard was playing conga, and you write he was the rare black person among the usual mix of white Claremont musicians. So, you know, you met, you dated, you fell in love, you eventually married. You both knew that there would be problems that you would face as an interracial couple. And he at first split up with you, claiming that it was because, you know, if you had children, and because he thought marriage would be the next step, and if you had children, that it would be really hard on the children. But you got together again, you had three children. What were some of the problems that you faced at the time, and what year are we talking about when you got married?
We got married in 1969, early 1969. And I think I read a statistic that in 1968, only 17% of the American population approved of interracial marriage. And in fact, I think the Loving versus the State of Virginia had very recently passed or been won. And so there was still a tremendous lack of acceptance of interracial couples. And we were pretty, if I could say so myself, pretty stunning. He was, tall and slim and good looking. And I wasn't so bad looking myself back then. And we dressed to the nines and went out and it did attract attention, and a lot of it negative. I mean, there were times when, there was one time when Leonard was actually beaten up at a party we had stopped in. And that was pretty shocking. But that and the housing situation was very tight. Claremont, like so many foothill communities, had covenants against selling to people of color or mixed couples. But that's not, interestingly enough, it wasn't about color or racism that brought the marriage down. It was addiction.
He had been addicted in high school. It sounds like he had a really bad alcohol problem in high school. He wasn't drinking when you met, at least not visibly. But then the first night you saw him falling down drunk was on your wedding night. And eventually it got really bad.
Yes.
And you tell the story of how, like, one night he beat you really badly.
Yes, he did. When I met Leonard, and he said that he had had a drinking problem in high school, but that he had taken care of it. He didn't have a problem anymore. I believed him 100%. We just didn't know much about addiction back then. We didn't have rehab centers, and people just weren't aware of what it meant. If you were an alcoholic, you probably didn't have the willpower to stop drinking, rather than having a disease or. And so as we approached life and our marriage, Leonard's problem did come back and get worse and worse. And I went to Al-Anon as a way to learn to cope with it. And that was something he did not, I snuck out actually, and he caught me and he got very angry. Yes. And he did get violent.
Why was he angry that you went to Al-Anon?
I think Leonard, with all the accumulated knowledge and I've looked into lots of research on addiction, I think he probably had a serious anxiety problem. He went to therapy for a while, and they suggested that he was manic depressive, as they called it back then. And I think that alcohol was his medication. I think it was self-medicating. I think he was terrified of not having alcohol.
So, Ellen, after you left your husband, you were the single mother of three young boys. What were their ages?
6, 4, and 2.
Okay, that's hard. You were supporting yourself, and also your children were biracial, and you were living in a predominantly white area.
And let's also be clear about that. Biracial didn't come into fashion until maybe like 2003. Like, Obama's the first black president. You know what I mean? I mean, it's like biracial is this wonderful pie in the sky concept that America can't seem to really catch up with.
Right. So you were black, is what you're saying.
I mean, yeah. Let's just, pardon the pun, but let's call a spade here.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Ellen, what did that mean for you? Because that, the single mother, three black children, white neighborhood, what are some of the things you were up against as a mother?
Well, as a single mother, there's plenty of challenges anyway. Aside from the fact of not having any money, or very much money, in the town, as much as it could make things difficult, could make things easy. It was a small town. Knew everybody. There was a very close circle of people. Then we did look out for each other. And my parents were very strong. They were always there for me and for my kids, whether they approved of me or how I was raising them or not. But they were definitely there and provided, I think, a really strong support system for the kids. That being said, yes, I was raising three black male children in a white area. Ben, I don't know if you remember this, but One time I was, I don't know where I was driving, somewhere, and I had the three boys in the back of the car, and I got pulled over. The cop comes up to the window, and he said, "Do you know what you did?" I said, "No, I don't." He said, "Well, you rolled a stop sign." And meanwhile, the kids in the back seat, they're really little, maybe 3, 5, and 7, saying, "Mom, what is a policeman, man? What is a policeman asking? Mom, what?" And he leans in the window, and he looks at the kids in the back, and he says, "Yeah, it's policeman now, but it'll be pig pretty soon." And I realized at that moment that I had a lot to try to teach these kids that I hadn't really realized. I mean, it was a real dawning of me on what this meant. And I said something to the cop about, you know, "I've raised my children to respect the police." And he said, "Well, I'm going to let you go with a warning." But it was a real, I don't know if you want to say come to Jesus moment, but kind of that for me.
I want to end with another song, and this is another duet that you recorded from the album of duets that you recorded in 2013 called Childhood Home that was released in 2014. Ben, you decided you wanted to do an album of duets with your mother, and this album was the result. This is your song I want to play, Born to Love You. Can you tell us about writing it before we hear it?
Yeah, it was one of the songs that came through in one swoop, went straight to the piano, and it was one of the songs, when I wrote it, I knew immediately where it was going to go, or I hoped it would go to my mom and I's record. And I held on to it for a good couple of years, and it made it on the album.
It's a great song. I want to thank you both so much. You know, there are many takeaways from your book, Ellen, but one of the takeaways from the book, and I think from this interview, is that you both are part of a remarkable family and that you are both remarkable. Thank you so much for sharing some of your stories with us. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for having us on the show.
Terry, thank you so much for having us on. It's a real honor. Thank you.
I was born to love you. Something I've been trying to say, but I couldn't find the way to tell you I was born to love you.
Some born to lose, some born to win. They say we're all born into sin. That's a hard way to begin, but I was born to love you.
That was Ellen Harper and her son Ben Harper from their album Childhood Home. Ellen is the author of the new memoir, Always a Song. Ben wrote the foreword. Our critic at large, John Power, says he reads a lot of books that are good, but only a few make him go, wow. One of those is the Copenhagen Trilogy, a memoir by the 20th century Danish writer Tove Ditlevsen, whose life was as messy as her books are controlled. John says the Copenhagen Trilogy belongs on the shelf of great books about women struggling to forge their own destiny.
We're living in a golden age for women's writing. It's not simply that a good new female writer seems to emerge every time you look up. It's that the wheels of literary justice are finally giving due process to great women writers whose work has been forgotten, ignored, or insufficiently appreciated. The latest revelation is Tove Ditlevsen, a Danish poet and fiction writer who I'd never even heard of until a few months ago. In her native Denmark, Ditlevsen, who committed suicide in 1976, is a renowned author whose popularity survived the condescension of the male establishment. Her brilliance is evident when you read her confessional memoir, The Copenhagen Trilogy, just out from Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, in a crisp translation by Taina Nunnally and Michael Favala Goldman. Told in a sneakily plain, highly addictive voice, it's the portrait of the artist as a young woman who wrote as hard as she lived. When we first meet Tove, she's a girl living in the district of Copenhagen known as Vesterbro, with its reeking streets, prostitutes, and endemic unemployment. While her father is principled, his progressive politics have limits. He insists that girls can't become poets. Her mother is an indolent beauty whose shifting moods Tove must constantly assess with the care of a lion tamer entering a cage. In love with words, Tove dreams of being a poet and writing her way to freedom. Not an easy task for a low-born girl in early 1930s Denmark. She has to start working at 14, taking jobs as a housekeeper, scullery maid, and office clerk. By night, she writes the poetry that sustains her, but that she fears will never see print. In fact, her writing does carry her away from Vesterbro, making her a success by her early 20s. She's even invited to dine with Evelyn Waugh. Yet for all her literary talent, she has little gift for daily living. Easily bored and fearing entrapment, Tove lurches through life. She goes on drunken revels with freedom-seeking girlfriends. She quickly racks up 4 husbands, dumping the 3 weak or pervy ones. She raises 3 kids, has a Christmastime abortion that haunts her, and finally, after an unnecessary surgery, gets hooked on the one thing she loves as much as writing: drugs. Such a summary may make the book sound harsh or depressing, but oddly, it's the opposite. Many of Tove's escapades are amusing, especially in Volume 2, and even the account of her Demerol addiction has a clear-eyed briskness that sucks us in with its immediacy. Perhaps because she was a poet, Ditlevsen knows the eloquence of leaving things out. The Copenhagen trilogy lies at the opposite end from Karl Ove Knausgård's My Struggle, whose 6 volumes try to tell us everything about his life, no matter how pedestrian. Her entire trilogy clicks in at a cool 367 pages, 100 fewer than the shortest volume of My Struggle, though her struggle was far greater than his. Like Grace Paley and Alice Munro, Ditlevsen's a master of compression, who can capture the whole story of a marriage in a couple of pages. With a born writer's killer instinct, she likes to pounce on us with arresting chapter openings, such as this first sentence about her second husband, Ebbe. "Whenever I try to recall his face," she tells us, "I always see him the way he looked that day I told him there was someone else." The Copenhagen trilogy is a story about escape. Escape from menial work, escape from traditional female roles, escape from boredom, escape from reality, and escape from the heavy weight of a self that was shaped in her childhood, a time she unforgettably compares to a long and narrow coffin. She has a self exploding with so many contradictions that she's like both heroines of Elena Ferrante's Neapolitan Quartet merged into one. Tove says she hates change, then invariably flees whatever life she's settled in. She insists she wants to be normal, but chooses a painfully unconventional path. She keeps telling us that she's passive and powerless, yet what makes the book hopeful is that she's anything but. Even if writing couldn't save her from herself, it lets her soar above the world's expectations and seek the truth on her own terms.
When we think of organized crime, we usually picture The Godfather or Goodfellas and New York tabloid murder stories. Our guest, writer Russell Shorto, says there were also mob families in countless smaller cities across the United States where the picture was a little different. He knows in part because he grew up in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, and his grandfather was a mob boss there when Johnstown was a bustling post-war industrial city. Shorto has a new memoir about his grandfather's colorful life running a criminal enterprise and running around on his wife, creating family havoc which would stretch across more than one generation. It's a well-researched and richly told story, from Shorto's immigrant ancestors overcoming discrimination and grinding poverty, to his own father making some tough choices about how he would fit into his father's life outside the law. Shorto is a contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine and author of several books of narrative history, including one about the origins of New York, the island at the center of the world. His new book is Small Time, A Story of My Family and the Mob. He joins me from his home in Cumberland, Maryland. Well, Russell Shorto, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Dave. I'm happy to be with you.
You grew up in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, which today has a population just under 20,000 people. Tell us a little bit about the place.
It was a classic boom town on the East Coast. It's now a Rust Belt town. It was booming with the steel mills, mostly. Bethlehem Steel was still going pretty strong when I was growing up. At its height, the population was, I think, 66,000. And as you said, it's now like 19,000. So it's really, in the following so many towns, it's a shadow of what it once was. But it's still a lovely place to, and I always say it's a lovely place to be from.
Right. You mentioned an East Coast town. It's really in western Pennsylvania, closer to Pittsburgh than Philly, kind of amid some of the hills there. Now, when you were growing up, your father was not in organized crime like your grandfather. Before you embarked on this project, how much did you know about your grandfather's life and business?
You know, I assume every family has its secrets, the things that people don't talk about, and yet kids somehow kind of absorb some information about it anyway. So I knew that he was involved in that stuff, and I didn't know what it was. I wouldn't go so far as to say there was a veil of silence, an official thing about on the topic, but we kind of knew. I was an obedient son, and I kind of knew about it, but also knew you didn't talk about it. So, you know, it was that kind of story, and it was, that veil was thick enough, I guess you'd say, that even though I write narrative history, it never occurred to me to sort of turn around and look at my own past and as a potential subject.
You know, I'll tell you, I read a lot of books for this job, and this one was just such a pleasure, and it is a rich history. Kind of under your nose all this time, what prompted you to finally look into it?
Well, in a nutshell, a guy named Frank. All of the people in the family who stayed in town, I think, pretty much internalized this. We don't go there. We're not going to talk about that. But Frank Filia, who is, so it's my father's father who we're talking about, who was kind of this small-time mob guy. But Frank was my mother's cousin. And all the Italians in town, I think, or a lot of them were connected in some way. And Frank had worked for my grandfather. He was a numbers runner, and he worked in a pool hall until he was around 20, and he was a musician. And then at that time, he left, went to Las Vegas, and spent his whole career there. He plays he still does. He plays stand-up bass, and he sings, you know, like Fly Me to the Moon and all that. And he then had retired, and he came back home. This was a few years ago, and I was home visiting over Christmas, and somebody said, hey, you know, Frank's in town, and he's playing at a club. You want to go see? And I said, who's Frank? And they said, Frank Filia, your mother's cousin. So we all go down to this little club. And there was a break between sets. And we're all kind of standing around in a circle. And he looks across at me, and he kind of wags his finger. And he says, Russell, you know, I've been wanting to talk to you. You're the writer. What are we going to do about the story? And I said, what story? And he said, your grandfather, the mob. And all the others, I could feel everyone else kind of cringing a little bit because, you know, they had this reflex, like, we don't go there. But for him, these were golden memories. And I, as the sort of dutiful son, said at the time, well, yeah, I write about the distant past. I'm not going to go there. But, you know, he kind of pestered me a little bit, and it stayed in my mind. And eventually that, I was living in Europe at the time, and eventually I said, Frank, you know what, I'm going to come home, and I'll spend a week just looking into this.
So your grandfather was the number two guy in this organization, which ran, you know, the mob in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. Give us a sense of what they did, where they hung out, how they made their money.
Yeah, he and his brother-in-law ran the operation together, and it was essentially gambling. And these are the days before television, or before television was big. And everyone in town who I interviewed over a certain age knew all about them. They all participated. Everybody played the numbers. And it was quite in the open. The center of their operation was a place called City Cigar on Main Street. It was two doors from City Hall. And they had, in the front, you walked in, and on the left was a little counter selling cigars and newspapers. And on the right was a lunch counter where a guy named Nino Bongiovanni would make sandwiches for you. And there was a door behind that. You walked through the door, and there was a long, narrow room with 10 pool tables and one billiards table and a counter, and the counter had a ticker tape machine on it that spat out sports scores. And this was their home base. And from here, they operated another pool hall further down the street that was for the mill workers. And it was kind of a blue-collar hangout. But here, this was for more the elite. You know, the lawyers and the mayor would come by. And so this was the center of the operation. And upstairs, they had an office. And from there, that's where all the bookies would report and bring their earnings. They had the center of their business was a numbers game that they called the GI Bank. And everybody in town played it, and they had something like 100 people in their employ, most of them just sort of on the side, but some full-time bookies. And they would that was the center of their operation. They also ran big-time card games for the bigwigs in town. And they sold something called tip seals, which were kind of like a lottery ticket. And that was an extremely popular game. And they had pinball machines. And pinball was actually a form of gambling. And people, the way it worked was you would have a pinball machine in your bar or your lunch counter or cafe or whatever it was, or in the lobby of a hotel. And you would win so many free games, and then you'd go up to the bartender, and they would pay you for those free games and then reset the machine. So they had many different ways to entertain you and to take your money.
All right, so we've got all these gambling operations, numbers runners all over the town and kind of the Johnstown and outlying towns, and they're all getting a take. It's right out in the open. Their headquarters is in the shadow of City Hall. They paid off, what, politicians? I mean, you know, Johnstown had a mayor and a police chief, and there was a county prosecutor. They all got a little cut.
Yeah, they paid people off. And as I say, it was out in the open. And periodically, there was they would have to raid for form's sake. And so they would give them a call and let them know, okay, we're going to send a guy down to raid. And so the idea was you would leave somebody behind. Everybody would clear out, and you'd take most of your betting slips. But you'd leave one guy behind, usually an older guy who kind of down on his luck and didn't have anything to lose by going and hanging out in jail for a day or two. And he would be there to take the fall. And then they'd kind of reset and start again. And one a friend of my dad's told me the story that he was a young guy. And they said, you know, hey, Bob, you want to make a little money, you take the fall. And he told me he was really indignant at this because he looked at himself as having a future and having promise. And he knew that the guy you pick to take the fall is a loser, basically. So he was really indignant at this. And in fact, he told me the story that he marched right out the back door, and the back door gave out onto another building where the draft office was. So he walked right in there and signed up for the Army. And he said, that's how I joined the Army.
Wow. So your grandfather was the number two guy in this organization that ran all kinds of gambling operations in Johnstown back in the day. They made, you know, there wasn't a lot of violence. I mean, a murder was a rare thing. There was one in 1960 of this bookie named Pippi DeFalco. That's one of the stories in the book. But by and large, it was a gambling operation. It did make a lot of money, didn't it?
Sure did, yeah. One insider, I eventually made my way to a guy who was my grandfather's protege, who was a great source of information. And he said that they made about $2 million a year over about a 20-year period. So a huge amount of money in those days.
There's a photo in the book of your grandfather, Russell Shorta, who bears your name, and his wife, your grandmother, Mary. It's in the front of the book. They are dressed to the nines, and they're at a nightclub in Atlantic City. What kind of lifestyle did this afford your grandfather and, you know, his brother-in-law, the boss, Little Joe, who ran the organization?
Well, on the surface, it was plain. You know, they had a no Cadillacs rule. You couldn't be showy. They didn't wear tailored suits. But when you got out of town, that was a different story. And so when they were in Atlantic City, where they went, they spent much of the summer every year with the whole family. They would bring a whole entourage of cars down to Atlantic City, and they rented a suite in the swankiest hotel. And They had waiters for everything. So, you know, they really lived it up. And they were often in Florida as well. So they lived it up when they were out of town. And everybody told me that when, you know, when you saw Russ, when you saw Joe, you just, you'd nod to them and, you know, you'd have a little conversation. But, you know, everything was kind of, my grandfather was a very quiet guy. He mumbled a lot. He was, some people said he was almost, they thought he was maybe pathologically shy. So he was good at putting up that kind of front.
You trace this story back to your ancestors in Sicily, where your grandfather's father, right, your great-grandfather, was born and emigrated to the United States in 1901. Tell us just a bit about his story.
Yeah, I really felt as I went into this that this is just the American immigrant story. It's just one variation of it. So you got all these waves of Italians coming, Southern Italians coming at that era. And I went to the village in Sicily that my great-grandparents were from. He emigrates. First, he gets a job working in a coal mine in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. Then he sends for his girlfriend. She comes over. And she then eventually becomes my great-grandmother. They move. And he, at the time, his name is Antonino Sciotto, S-C-I-O-T-T-O. And when they make the move from Punxsutawney to Johnstown, there's a name change. So they're no longer Antonino and Anna Maria. They become Tony and Mary Sciotto. So you see them sort of Americanizing or trying to, but he's still working in the coal mines. And that generation remains immigrants. They mainly speak Italian or Sicilian. That's who they associate with. And it's really then their children who are truly Americans, but still in this kind of limited, discriminated against way.
What kind of discrimination did they face as Italians?
Italians, you know, at Southern Italians, there was a distinction. Southern Italians, because they came in such waves, they were considered quasi-black, so to speak. And the migration, this huge influx of Southern Italians, is what largely brought about the return of the Klan, the KKK, which had, of course, come about after the Civil War and then died out. But it came back with a vengeance to defend American values against especially Catholics and especially these kind of dark-skinned, swarthy immigrants who were threatening the American way of life, which meant this Protestant way of life. So they experienced real hardship and real discrimination. For example, the steel mill was the big employer in Johnstown. Blacks and Italians couldn't work there, except in you know certain very low-level dangerous jobs, unless there was a strike, and then they were in as the scabs.
So your grandfather grows up really poor, one of nine children of this immigrant woman. When Prohibition comes, your great-grandmother actually keeps a still in the basement, and your great-grandfather carries bottles of this stuff around in Coke bottles full of the hooch. How did he get embarked upon this life of gambling and card sharking and all this?
His story really tracks the rise of the mob in the country. It grows out of Prohibition. You know, these were people discriminated against. They didn't have access to the mainstream. So they sort of created their own system. And when Prohibition happened, here was an opportunity. There was a demand everywhere for a product, and what had been the legal makers of it couldn't make it anymore, so they began doing it. And it was neighborhood organizers. In this case, there was an old Italian guy in the neighborhood who seems to have organized families to operate stills, and kids would go out and sell it. And so he grew up with that. And after Prohibition, the mob generally, and in the case of my grandfather in particular, shifted to a different revenue stream, and that was gambling. And so we kind of see him. His first arrests that the records that I got were of him running card and dice games out of the trunk of a car. So he's now late teens, early 20s, and he's moved into that, and that's how he kind of moves into that operation.
So this organization that your grandfather and his brother-in-law ran in Johnstown had a great run in the 40s, 50s. Things changed in the 60s, and it kind of fell apart. Why?
Well, throughout the 50s, of course, there was this growing pressure in American society for the government to recognize that there was this organized crime syndicate that was all over the country. And until then, during their heyday, they were able to, my grandfather and his brother-in-law were able to operate quite in the open. And I think Kennedy coming into the White House, Bobby Kennedy deciding he's cracking down on the mob, and then this inconvenient murder of a bookie in town, all those things happen at the same time. And that brings this new focus. Suddenly, you had the Tribune Democrat, which was the main newspaper, and they would, you know, report main stories. But you had this weekly called the Johnstown Observer, and they would report gossip on what was going on. And for several years before this, they were saying, hey, these guys out of City Cigar, they're just, you know, running the town and doing whatever they want. And why aren't the police doing anything about it? Well, it was because they were being paid off. But now suddenly those stories get shifted from the Observer to the regular paper. And suddenly all this pressure is being brought to bear. And there's a new mayor, and he's kind of a, we got to clean up this town kind of mayor. And that spelled the beginning of the end. That murder, suddenly within a couple of months, City Cigar shut down for good. They continued their operation for a long time, but it was on a much lower level.
Well, Russell Shorto, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Dave.
Russell Shorto is a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine and the author of several books of narrative history. His new memoir is Small Time, A Story of My Family and the Mob.